soap. "Ma'am," said the keeper, "you all just take him on to the river." Toadvine and the kid passed them as they were dragging the cart along. They stepped off the path and watched them go by. The idiot was clutching the bars and hooting at the water, and some of the women had started up a hymn.
"Where are they taking it?" said Toadvine.
The kid didn't know. They were backing the cart through the loose sand toward the edge of the river, and they let it down and opened the cage. The Borginnis woman stood before the imbecile.
"James Robert, come out of there."
She reached in and took him by the hand. He peered past her at the water, then he reached for her. A sigh went up from the women, several of whom had hiked their skirts and tucked them at the waist, and now stood in the river to receive him. She handed him down, him clinging to her neck. When his feet touched the ground, he turned to the water. She was smeared with feces, but she seemed not to notice. She looked back at those on the riverbank.
"Burn that thing," she said.
Someone ran to the fire for a brand, and while they led James Robert into the waters, the cage was torched and began to burn. He clutched at their skirts. He reached with a clawed hand, gibbering, drooling.
"He sees himself in it," they said. "Shoo! Imagine having this child penned up like a wild animal."
The flames from the burning cart crackled in the dry air, and the noise must have caught the idiot's attention, for he turned his dead black eyes upon it.
"He knows," they said.
All agreed. The Borginnis woman waded out with her dress ballooning about her and took him deeper, and swirled him about, grown man that he was, in her great stout arms. She held him up. She crooned to him. Her pale hair floated on the water. His old companion saw him that night before the migrants' fires in a coarse woven wool suit. His thin neck turned warily in the collar of his outsized shirt. They'd greased his hair and combed it flat upon his skull so that it looked painted on. They brought him sweets, and he sat drooling and watched the fire, greatly to their admiration. In the dark, the river ran on, and a fish-colored moon rose over the desert east and set their shadows by their sides in the barren light. The fires drew down, and the smoke stood gray and chambered in the night. The little jackal wolves cried from across the river, and the camp dogs stirred and muttered. The Borginnis took the idiot to his pallet under a wagon sheet and stripped him to his new underwear, and she tucked him into his blanket and kissed him goodnight, and the camp grew quiet. When the idiot crossed that blue and smoky amphitheater, he was naked once again, shambling past the fires like a balden ground sloth. He paused and tested the air, and he shuffled on. He went wide of the landing and stumbled through the shore willows, whimpering and pushing with his thin arms at things in the night. Then he was standing alone on the shore. He hooted softly, and his voice passed from him like a gift that was also needed, so that no sound of it echoed back. He entered the water. Before the river reached much past his waist, he'd lost his footing and sunk from sight. Now the judge, on his midnight rounds, was passing along at just this place, stark naked himself, such encounters being commoner than men suppose, or who would survive any crossing by night. And he stepped into the river and seized up the drowning idiot, snatching it aloft by the heels like a great midwife, and slapping it on the back to let the water out. A birth scene, or a baptism, or some ritual not yet inaugurated into any canon. He twisted the water from its hair, and he gathered the naked and sobbing fool into his arms, and carried it up into the camp, and restored it among its fellows. Chapter 19. The Howitzer. The Yuma's Attack. A Skirmish. Glanton Appropriates the Ferry. The Hanged Judas. The Coffers. A Deputation for the Coast. San Diego. arranging for supplies. Brown at the farrier's. A dispute. Webster and Toadvine freed. The ocean. An altercation. A man burned alive. Brown endurance vile. Tales of treasure. An escape. A murder in the mountains. Glanton leaves Yuma. The Alcalde hanged. Hostages. Returns to Yuma. Doctor and judge, nigger and fool. Dawn on the river. Carts without wheels. Murder of Jackson. The Yuma Massacre. The doctor had been bound for California when the ferry fell into his hands, for the most by chance. In the ensuing months, he'd amassed a considerable wealth in gold and silver and jewelry. He and the two men who worked for him had taken up residence on the west bank of the river, overlooking the ferry landing, among the abutments of an unfinished hillside fortification made from mud and rock. In addition to the pair of freight wagons he'd inherited from Major Graham's command, he had also a mountain howitzer, a bronze 12-pounder with a bore the size of a saucer, and this piece stood idle and unloaded in its wooden truck. In the doctor's crude quarters, he and Glanton and the judge, together with Brown and Irving, sat drinking tea, and Glanton sketched for the doctor a few of their Indian adventures, and advised him strongly to secure his position. The doctor demurred. He claimed to get along well with the Yumas. Glanton told him to his face that any man who trusted an Indian was a fool. The doctor colored, but he held his tongue. The judge intervened. He asked the doctor did he consider the pilgrims huddled on the far shore to be under his protection. The doctor said that he did so consider them. The judge spoke reasonably and with concern, and when Glanton and his detail returned down the hill to cross to their camp, they had the doctor's permission to fortify the hill and charge the howitzer. And to this end they set about running the last of their lead until they had close on to a hatful of rifle balls. They loaded the howitzer that evening with something like a pound of powder and the entire cast of shot, and they trundled the piece to a place of advantage overlooking the river and the landing below. 2 days later, the Yumas attacked the crossing. The scows were on the west bank of the river, discharging cargo as arranged, and the travelers stood by to claim their goods. The savages came, both mounted and afoot, out of the willows with no warning, and swarmed across the open ground toward the ferry. On the hill above them, Brown and Long Webster swung the howitzer and steadied it, and Brown crammed his lighted cigar into the touch-hole. Even over that open terrain, the concussion was immense. The howitzer and its truck leaped from the ground and clattered smoking backward across the packed clay. On the floodplain below the fort, a terrible destruction had passed, and upward of a dozen of the Yumas lay dead or writhing in the sand. A great howl went up among them, and Glanton and his riders defiled out of the wood littoral upriver, and rode upon them, and they cried out in rage at their betrayal. Their horses began to mill, and they pulled them about, and loosed arrows at the approaching dragoons, and were shot down in volleys of pistol fire, and the debarkees at the crossing scrabbled up their arms from among the dunnage, and knelt and set up a fire from that quarter, while the women and children lay prone among the trunks and freight boxes. The horses of the Yumas reared and screamed, and churned about in the loose sand with their hoop-shaped nostrils and whited eyes, and the survivors made for the willows from which they'd emerged, leaving on the field the wounded and the dying and the dead. Glanton and his men did not pursue them. They dismounted and walked methodically among the fallen, dispatching them, man and horse alike, each with a pistol ball through the brain while the ferry travelers watched, and then they took the scalps. The doctor stood on the low parapet of the works in silence, and watched the bodies dragged down the landing and booted and shoved into the river. He turned and looked at Brown and Webster. They'd hauled the howitzer back to its position, and Brown sat easily on the warm barrel, smoking his cigar and watching the activity below. The doctor turned and walked back to his quarters. nor did he appear the following day. Glanton took charge of the operation of the ferry. People who had been waiting 3 days to cross at a dollar a head were now told that the fare was $4. And even this tariff was in effect for no more than a few days. Soon they were operating a sort of Procrustean ferry where the fares were tailored to accommodate the purses of the travelers. Ultimately, all pretense was dropped, and the immigrants were robbed outright. Travelers were beaten, and their arms and goods appropriated, and they were sent destitute and beggared into the desert. The doctor came down to remonstrate with them, and was paid his share of the revenues and sent back. Horses were taken, and women violated, and bodies began to drift past the Yuma camp downriver. As these outrages multiplied, the doctor barricaded himself in his quarters and was seen no more. In the following month, a company from Kentucky under General Patterson arrived, and disdaining to bargain with Glanton, constructed a ferry downriver, and crossed and moved on. This ferry was taken over by the Yumas, and operated for them by a man named Callahan. But within days it was burned, and Callahan's headless body floated anonymously downriver, a vulture standing between the shoulder blades in clerical black, silent rider to the sea. Easter in that year fell on the last day of March, and at dawn on that day, the kid, together with Toadvine and a boy named Billy Carr, crossed the river to cut willow poles at a place where they grew upstream from the encampment of immigrants. Passing through this place before it was yet good light, they encountered a party of Sonorans up and about, and they saw hanging from a scaffold a poor Judas, fashioned from straw and old rags, who wore on his canvas face a painted scowl that reflected in the hand that had executed it no more than a child's conception of the man and his crime. The Sonorans had been up since midnight drinking, and they had lit a bonfire on the bench of loam where the gibbet stood. And as the Americans passed along the edge of their camp, they called out to them in Spanish. Someone had brought a long cane from the fire, tipped with lighted tow, and the Judas was being set afire. Its raggedy clothes were packed with squibs and rockets, and as the fire took hold, it began to blow apart piece by piece in a shower of burning rags and straw, until at last a bomb and its breeches went off, and blew the thing to pieces in a stink of soot and sulfur. And the men cheered, and small boys threw a few last stones at the blackened remnants dangling from the noose. The kid was the last to pass through the clearing, and the Sonorans called out to him, and offered him wine from a goatskin. But he shrugged up his rag of a coat about his shoulders and hurried on. By now, Glanton had enslaved a number of Sonorans, and he kept crews of them working at the fortification of the hill. There were also detained in their camp a dozen or more Indian and Mexican girls, some little more than children. Glanton supervised with some interest the raising of the walls about him, but otherwise left his men to pursue the business at the crossing with a terrible latitude. He seemed to take little account of the wealth they were amassing, although daily he'd open the brass lock with which the wood and leather trunk in his quarters was secured, and raise the lid and empty whole sacks of valuables into it, the trunk already holding thousands of dollars in gold and silver coins, as well as jewelry, watches, pistols, raw gold and little leather stives, silver in bars, knives, silverware, plate, teeth. On the 2nd of April, David Brown, with Long Webster and Toadvine, set out for the town of San Diego on the old Mexican coast for the purpose of obtaining supplies. They took with them a string of pack animals, and they left at sunset, riding up out of the trees and looking back at the river, and then walking the horses sideways down the dunes into the cool blue dusk. They crossed the desert in 5 days without incident, and rode up through the coastal range, and led the mules through the snow in the gap, and descended the western slope, and entered the town in a slow drizzle of rain. Their hide clothing was heavy with water, and the animals were stained with the silt that had leached out of them and their trappings. Mounted U.S. cavalry passed them in the mud of the street, and in the distance beyond they could hear the sea boom shuddering on the gray and stony coast. Brown took from the horn of his saddle a fiber morale filled with coins, and the three of them dismounted and entered a whiskey grocer's, and unannounced they upended the sack on the grocer's board. There were doubloons minted in Spain and in Guadalajara, and half doubloons, and gold dollars, and tiny gold half dollars, and French coins of 10-franc value, and gold eagles, and half eagles, and ring dollars, and dollars minted in North Carolina and Georgia that were 22 carats pure. The grocer weighed them out by stacks in a common scale, sorted by their mintings, and he drew corks and poured measures round in small tin cups whereon the gills were stamped. They drank and set down the cups again, and he pushed the bottle across the raw sash-milled boards of the counter. They had drafted a list of supplies to be contracted for, and when they'd agreed on the price of flour and coffee and a few other staples, they turned into the street, each with a bottle in his fist. They went down the plankboard walkway and crossed through the mud, and they went past rows of raw-looking shacks and crossed a small plaza beyond which they could see the low sea rolling, and a small encampment of tents, and a street where the squatting houses were made of hides ranged like curious dories along the selvage of sea oats above the beach, and quite black and shining in the rain. It was in one of these that Brown woke the next morning. He had little recollection of the prior night, and there was no one in the hut with him. The remainder of their money was in a bag around his neck. He pushed open the framed hide door and stepped out into the darkness and the mist. They'd neither put up nor fed their animals, and he made his way back to the grocer's where they were tied and sat on the walkway and watched the dawn come down from the hills behind the town. Noon he was red-eyed and reeking before the alcalde's door, demanding the release of his companions. The alcalde vacated out the back of the premises, and shortly there arrived an American corporal and two soldiers who warned him away. An hour later he was at the farriery, standing warily in the doorway, peering into the gloom until he could make out the shape of things within. The farrier was at his bench, and Brown entered and laid before him a polished mahogany case with a brass nameplate branded to the lid. He unsnapped the catches and opened the case, and raised from their recess within a pair of shotgun barrels, and he took up the stock with the other hand. He hooked the barrels into the patent breech and stood the shotgun on the bench, and pushed the fitted pin home to secure the forearm. He cocked the hammers with his thumbs and let them fall again. The shotgun was English-made, and had Damascus barrels and engraved locks, and the stock was burl mahogany. He looked up. The farrier was watching him.
"You work on guns?" said Brown.
"I do, some.
I need these barrels cut down."
The man took the gun and held it in his hands. There was a raised center rib between the barrels, and inlaid in gold the maker's name, London. There were two platinum bands in the patent breech, and the locks and hammers were chased with scrollwork cut deeply in the steel, and there were partridges engraved at either end of the maker's name there. The purple barrels were welded up from triple scalps, and the hammered iron and steel bore a watered figure like the markings of some alien and antique serpent, rare and beautiful and lethal. And the wood was figured with a deep red feather grain at the butt, and held a small spring-loaded silver cap-box in the toe. The farrier turned the gun in his hands and looked at Brown. He looked down at the case. It was lined with green baize, and there were little fitted compartments that held a wad-cutter, a pewter powder flask, cleaning jags, a patent pewter capper.
"You need what?" he said. "Cut the barrels down. Long about in here."
He held a finger across the piece.
"I can't do that."
Brown looked at him.
"You can't do it?"
"No, sir."
He looked around the shop.
"Well," he said, I'd have thought any damn fool could saw the barrels off a shotgun.
There's something wrong with you. Why would anybody want to cut the barrels off a gun like this?
What did you say?
Said Brown. The man tendered the gun nervously.
I just meant that I don't see why anybody would want to ruin a good gun like this here. What would you take for it?
It ain't for sale. You think there's something wrong with me?
No, I don't. I didn't mean it that way.
Are you going to cut them barrels down, or ain't you?
I can't do that.
Can't or won't?
You pick the one that best suits you.
Brown took the shotgun and laid it on the bench.
What would you have to do it?
He said.
I ain't doing it.
If a man wanted it done, what would be a fair price?
I don't know. A dollar?
Brown reached into his pocket and came up with a handful of coins. He laid a $2.50 gold piece on the bench.
Now, he said, I'm paying you $2.50.
The farrier looked at the coin nervously.
I don't need your money, he said. You can't pay me to butcher that there gun.
You done been paid.
No, I ain't.
Yonder it lays. Now you can either get to sawin' or you can default, in the case of which I aim to take it out of your ass.
The farrier didn't take his eyes off Brown. He began to back away from the bench, and then he turned and ran. When the sergeant of the guard arrived, Brown had the shotgun chucked up in the bench vise and was working at the barrels with a hacksaw. The sergeant walked around to where he could see his face.
"What do you want?" said Brown. "This man says you threatened his life." "What man?"
"This man." The sergeant nodded toward the door of the shed. Brown continued to saw.
"You call that a man?" he said.
"I'd never give him no leave to come in here and use my tools, neither," said the farrier.
"How about it?" said the sergeant. "How about what? How do you answer to this man's charges?" "He's a liar."
"You never threatened him?"
"That's right."
"The hell he never..."
"I don't threaten people. I told him I'd whip his ass, and that's as good as notarized."
"You don't call that a threat?"
Brown looked up.
"It was not no threat. It was a promise."
He bent to the work again, and another few passes with the saw and the barrels dropped to the dirt. He laid down the saw and backed off the jaws of the vise and lifted out the shotgun and unpinned the barrels from the stock and fitted the pieces into the case and shut the lid and latched it.
"What was the argument about?" said the sergeant. "There wasn't no argument that I know of."
"You better ask him where he got that gun he's just ruined. He stole that somewhere, as you can wager on it."
"Where'd you get the shotgun?" said the sergeant.
Brown bent down and picked up the severed barrels. They were about 18 inches long, and he had them by the small end. He came around the bench and walked past the sergeant. He put the gun case under his arm. At the door, he turned. The farrier was nowhere in sight. He looked at the sergeant.
"I believe that man has done withdrawed his charges," he said. "Like as not, he was drunk."
As he was crossing the plaza toward the little mud cabildo, he encountered Toadvine and Webster, newly released. They were wild-looking, and they stank. The three of them went down to the beach and sat looking out at the long gray swells and passing Brown's bottle among them. They'd none of them seen an ocean before. Brown walked down and held his hand to the sheet of spume that ran up the dark sand. He lifted his hand and tasted the salt on his fingers. And he looked down coast and up, and then they went back up the beach toward the town. They spent the afternoon drinking in a Lazarus bodega run by a Mexican. Some soldiers came in. An altercation took place. Toadvine was on his feet, swaying. A peacemaker rose from among the soldiers, and soon the principals were seated again. But minutes later, Brown, on his way back from the bar, poured a pitcher of aguardiente over a young soldier and set him afire with his cigar.
The man ran outside mute, save for the whoosh of the flames, and the flames were pale blue and then invisible in the sunlight. And he fought them in the street like a man beset with bees or madness. And then he fell over in the road and burned up. By the time they got to him with a bucket of water, he had blackened and shriveled in the mud like an enormous spider. Brown woke in a dark little cell, manacled and crazed with thirst. The first thing he consulted for was the bag of coins. It was still inside his shirt. He rose up from the straw and put one eye to the Judas hole. It was day. He called out for someone to come. He sat and with his chained hands counted out the coins and put them back in the bag. In the evening he was brought his supper by a soldier. The soldier's name was Pettit, and Brown showed him his necklace of ears, and he showed him the coins. Pettit said he wanted no part of his schemes. Brown told him how he had $30,000 buried in the desert. He told him of the ferry, installing himself in Glanton's place. He showed him the coins again, and he spoke familiarly of their places of origin, supplementing the judge's reports with impromptu data. "Even shares," he hissed. "You and me." He studied the recruit through the bars. Pettit wiped his forehead with his sleeve. Brown scooped the coins back into the poke and handed them out to him.
"You think we can't trust one another?" he said.
The boy stood holding the sack of coins uncertainly. He tried to push it back through the bars. Brown stepped away and held his hands up.
"Don't be a fool," he hissed. "What do you think I'd give to have such a chance at your age?"
When Pettit was gone, he sat in the straw and looked at the thin metal plate of beans and the tortillas. After a while, he ate. Outside, it was raining again, and he could hear riders passing in the mud of the street, and soon it was dark. They left 2 nights later. They had each a passable saddle horse and a rifle and blanket, and they had a mule that carried provisions of dried corn and beef and dates. They rode up into the dripping hills, and in the first light, Brown raised the rifle and shot the boy through the back of the head. The horse lurched forward, and the boy toppled backward, the entire foreplate of his skull gone and the brains exposed. Brown halted his mount and got down and retrieved the sack of coins and took the boy's knife and took his rifle and his powder flask and his coat, and he cut the ears from the boy's head and strung them onto his scapular, and then he mounted up and rode on. The pack mule followed, and after a while, so did the horse the boy had been riding. When Webster and Toadvine rode into the camp at Yuma, they had neither provisions nor the mules they'd left with. Glanton took 5 men and rode out at dusk, leaving the judge in charge of the ferry. They reached San Diego in the dead of night and were directed to the alcalde's house. This man came to the door in nightshirt and stocking cap, holding a candle before him. Glanton pushed him back into the parlor and sent his men on to the rear of the house, from whence they heard directly a woman's screams and a few dull slaps and then silence. The alcalde was a man in his 60s, and he turned to go to his wife's aid and was struck down with a pistol barrel. He stood up again, holding his head. Glanton pushed him on to the rear room. He had in his hand a rope already fashioned into a noose, and he turned the alcalde around and put the noose over his head and pulled it taut. The wife was sitting up in bed, and at this she commenced to scream again. One of her eyes was swollen and closing rapidly, and now one of the recruits hit her flush in the mouth, and she fell over in the tousled bedding and put her hands over her head. Glanton held the candle aloft and directed one of the recruits to boost the other on his shoulders, and the boy reached along the top of one of the vigas until he found a space, and he fitted the end of the rope through and let it down, and they hauled on it and raised the mute and struggling alcalde into the air. They'd not tied his hands, and he groped wildly overhead for the rope and pulled himself up to save strangling, and he kicked his feet and revolved slowly in the candlelight.
"Válgame Dios!" he gasped. "¿Qué quiere?"
"I want my money," said Glenn. "I want my money, and I want my pack mules, and I want David Brown."
"¿Cómo?"
wheezed the old man. Someone had lit a lamp. The old woman raised up and saw first the shadow and then the form of her husband dangling from the rope, and she began to crawl across the bed toward him.
"Dígame,"
gasped the alcalde. Someone reached to seize the wife, but Glanton motioned him away, and she staggered out of the bed and took hold of her husband about the knees to hold him up. She was sobbing and praying for mercy to Glanton and to God impartially. Glanton walked around to where he could see the man's face. "I want my money," he said. "My money and my mules and the man I sent out here.
El hombre que tiene usted. Mi compañero." "No, no,"
gasped the hangman.
"Búscale. No man is here."
"Where is he?"
"He is no here."
"Yes, he's here, in the juzgado."
"No, no. Madre de Jesús, no here. He's gone. 7-8 días.
"Where is the juzgado?"
"¿Cómo?
El juzgado. ¿Dónde está?" The old woman turned loose with one arm long enough to point, her face pressed to the man's leg.
"Allá," she said. "Allá."
Two men went out, one holding the stub of the candle and shielding the flame with his cupped hand before him. When they came back, they reported the little dungeon in the building out back empty. Glanton studied the alcalde. The old woman was visibly tottering. They'd half-hitched the rope about the tailpost of the bed, and he loosed the rope, and the alcalde and the wife collapsed onto the floor. They left them bound and gagged, and rode out to visit the grocer. 3 days later, the alcalde and the grocer and the alcalde's wife were found tied and lying in their own excrement in an abandoned hut at the edge of the ocean 8 miles south of the settlement. They'd been left a pan of water, from which they drank like dogs, and they had howled at the booming surf in that wayplace until they were mute as stones. Glanton and his men were 2 days and nights in the streets, crazed with liquor. The sergeant in charge of the small garrison of American troops confronted them in a drinking exchange on the evening of the second day, and he and the three men with him were beaten senseless and stripped of their arms. At dawn, when the soldiers kicked in the hostel door, there was no one in the room. Glanton returned to Yuma alone, his men gone to the gold fields. On that bone-strewn waste he encountered wretched parcels of foot travelers who called out to him, and men dead where they'd fallen, and men who would die, and groups of folks clustered about a last wagon or cart, shouting hoarsely at the mules or oxen, and goading them on as if they bore in those frail caissons the covenant itself. And these animals would die, and the people with them. And they called out to that lone horseman to warn him of the danger at the crossing. And the horseman rode on, all contrary to the tide of refugees, like some storied hero, toward what beast of war or plague or famine, with what set to his relentless jaw. When he reached Yuma, he was drunk. Behind him on a string were two small jacks laden with whiskey and biscuit. He sat his horse and looked down at the river, who was keeper of the crossroads of all that world, and his dog came to him and nuzzled his foot in the stirrup. A young Mexican girl was crouched naked under the shade of the wall. She watched him ride past, covering her breasts with her hands. She wore a rawhide collar about her neck, and she was chained to a post, and there was a clay bowl of blackened meat scraps beside her. Glanton tied the jacks to the post and rode inside on the horse. There was no one about. He rode down to the landing. While he was watching the river, the doctor came scrambling down the bank and seized Glanton by the foot and began to plead with him in a senseless jabber. He had not seen to his person in weeks, and he was filthy and disheveled, and he tugged at Glanton's trouser leg and pointed toward the fortifications on the hill.
"That man," he said, "that man!"
Glanton slid his boot from the stirrup and pushed the doctor away with his foot, and turned the horse and rode back up the hill. The judge was standing on the rise in silhouette against the evening sun like some great Baldwin Archimandrite. He was wrapped in a mantle of free-flowing cloth, beneath which he was naked. The black man Jackson came out of one of the stone bunkers dressed in a similar garb and stood beside him. Glanton rode back up along the crest of the hill to his quarters. All night gunfire drifted intermittently across the water, and laughter and drunken oaths. When day broke, no one appeared. The ferry lay at its moorings, and across the river a man came down to the landing and blew a horn and waited, and then went back. The ferry stood idle all that day. By evening the drunkenness and revelry had begun afresh, and the shrieks of young girls carried across the water to the pilgrims huddled in their camp. Someone had given the idiot whiskey mixed with sarsaparilla, and this thing which could little more than walk had commenced to dance before the fire with loping simian steps, moving with great gravity and smacking its loose wet lips. At dawn, the black walked out to the landing and stood urinating in the river. The scows lay downstream against the bank with a few inches of sandy water standing in the floorboards. He pulled his robes about him and stepped aboard the thwart and balanced there. The water ran over the boards toward him. He stood looking out. The sun was not up, and there was a low skein of mist on the water. Downstream, some ducks moved out from the willows. They circled in the eddy water and then flapped out across the open river and rose and circled and bent their way upstream. In the floor of the scow was a small coin, perhaps once lodged under the tongue of some passenger. He bent to fetch it. He stood up and wiped the grit from the piece and held it up, and as he did so, a long cane arrow passed through his upper abdomen and flew on and fell far out in the river and sank and backed to the surface again and began to turn and to drift downstream. He faced around, his robe sustained about him. He was holding his wound, and with his other hand he ravaged among his clothes for the weapons that were not there and were not there. A second arrow passed him on the left, and two more struck and lodged fast in his chest and in his groin. They were a full 4 feet in length, and they lofted slightly with his movements like ceremonial wands. And he seized his thigh where the dark arterial blood was spurting along the shaft, and took a step toward the shore and fell sideways into the river. The water was shallow, and he was moving weakly to regain his feet when the first of the Yumas leaped aboard the scow. Completely naked, his hair dyed orange, his face painted black, with a crimson line dividing it from widow's peak to chin. He stamped his feet twice on the boards and flared his arms like some wild thaumaturge out of an atavistic drama, and reached and seized the black by his robes where he lay in the reddening waters, and raised him up and stove in his head with his war club. They swarmed up the hill toward the fortifications where the Americans lay sleeping, and some were mounted and some afoot, and all of them armed with bows and clubs, and their faces blacked or pale with fard, and their hair bound up in clay. The first quarters they entered were Lincoln's. When they emerged a few minutes later, one of them carried the doctor's dripping head by the hair, and others were dragging behind them the doctor's dog, bound at the muzzle, jerking and bucking across the dry clay of the concourse. They entered a wicky-up of willow poles and canvas, and slew Gunn and Wilson and Henderson Smith each in turn as they reared up drunkenly. And they moved on among the rude half-walls in total silence, glistening with paint and grease and blood among the bands of light where the risen sun now touched the higher ground. When they entered Glanton's chamber, he lurched upright and glared wildly about him. The small clay room he occupied was entirely filled with a brass bed he'd appropriated from some migrating family, and he sat in it like a debauched feudal baron, while his weapons hung in a rich array from the finials. Caballo and Pelo mounted into the actual bed with him, and stood there, while one of the attending tribunal handed him at his right side a common axe, the hickory helve of which was carved with pagan motifs and tasseled with the feathers of predatory birds. Glanton spat.
"Hack away, you mean red nigger," he said.
And the old man raised the axe and split the head of John Joel Glanton to the thrapple. When they entered the judge's quarters, they found the idiot and a girl of perhaps 12 years cowering naked in the floor. Behind them, also naked, stood the judge. He was holding leveled at them the bronze barrel of the howitzer. The wooden truck stood on the floor, the straps pried up and twisted off the pillow blocks. The judge had the cannon under one arm, and he was holding a lighted cigar over the touch hole. The Yumas fell over one another backward, and the judge put the cigar in his mouth and took up his portmanteau and stepped out the door and backed past them and down the embankment. The idiot, who reached just to his waist, stuck close to his side, and together they entered the wood at the base of the hill and disappeared from sight. The savages built a bonfire on the hill and fueled it with the furnishings from the white men's quarters, and they raised up Glanton's body and bore it aloft in the manner of a slain champion and hurled it onto the flames. They'd tied his dog to his corpse, and it was snatched after in howling suttee to disappear crackling in the rolling greenwood smoke. The doctor's torso was dragged up by the heels and raised and flung onto the pyre, and the doctor's mastiff also was committed to the flames. It slid, struggling, down the far side, and the thongs with which it was tied must have burnt in two, for it began to crawl, charred and blind and smoking from the fire, and was flung back with a shovel. The other bodies, 8 in number, were heaped onto the fire, where they sizzled and stank, and the thick smoke rolled out over the river. The doctor's head had been mounted upon a paling and carried about, but at the last it, too, was thrown onto the blaze. The guns and clothing were divided upon the clay, and divided, too, were the gold and silver out of the hacked and splintered chest that they'd dragged forth. All else was heaped on the flames, and while the sun rose and glistened on their gaudy faces, they sat upon the ground, each with his new goods before him. And they watched the fire and smoked their pipes as might some painted troop of mime folk, recruiting themselves in such a wayplace far from the towns and the rabble hooting at them across the smoking footlamps, contemplating towns to come, and the poor fanfare of trumpet and drum, and the rude boards upon which their destinies were inscribed, for these people were no less bound and indentured. And they watched, like the prefiguration of their own ends, the carbonized skulls of their enemies incandescing before them, bright as blood, among the coals. Chapter 20. The Escape. Into the Desert. Pursued by the Yumas. A Stand. Alamo Mucho. Another Refugee. A Siege. At Long Taw. Night Fires. The Judge Lives. At Barter in the Desert. How the Ex-Priest Comes to Advocate Murder. Setting Forth. Another Encounter. Carrizo Creek. An Attack. Among the Bones. Playing for Keeps. An Exorcism. Tobin Wounded. A Counseling. The Slaughter of the Horses. The Judge on Torts. Another Escape, Another Desert.
Toadvine and the kid fought a running engagement upriver through the shore bracken, with arrows clattering through the cane all about them. They came out of the willow brakes and climbed the dunes and descended the far side and reappeared again, two dark figures anguishing upon the sands, now trotting, now stooping, the report of the pistol flat and dead in the open country. The Yumas who crested out on the dunes were four in number, and they didn't follow, but rather fixed them upon the terrain to which they had committed themselves, and then turned back. The kid carried an arrow in his leg, and it was butted against the bone. He stopped and sat and broke off the shaft a few inches from the wound, and then he got up again, and they went on. At the crest of the rise, they stopped and looked back. The Yumas had already left the dunes, and they could see the smoke rising darkly along the river bluff. To the west, the country was all rolling sandhills, where a man might lie in hiding. But there was no place the sun would not find him, and only the wind could hide his tracks.
"Can you walk?" said Toadvine.
"I ain't got no choice."
"How much water you got?"
"Not much."
"What do you want to do?"
"I don't know."
"We could ease back to the river and lay up," said Toadvine.
"Till what?"
He looked toward the fort again, and he looked at the broken shaft in the kid's leg and the welling blood.
"You want to try and pull that?"
"No."
"What do you want to do?"
"Go on."
They mended their course and picked up the trail the wagon parties followed, and they went on through the long forenoon and the day and the evening of the day. By dark, their water was gone, and they labored on beneath the slow wheel of stars and slept shivering among the dunes and rose in the dawn and went on again. The kid's leg had stiffened, and he hobbled after with a section of wagon tongue for a crutch, and twice he told Toadvine to go on, but he wouldn't. Before noon, the Aborigines appeared. They watched them assemble upon the trembling drop of the eastern horizon, like baleful marionettes. They were without horses, and they seemed to be moving at a trot, and within the hour they were lofting arrows upon the refugees. They went on, the kid with his pistol drawn, stepping and ducking the shafts where they fell out of the sun, the lengths of them glistening against the pale sky and foreshortening in a reedy flutter, and then suddenly quivering dead in the ground. They snapped off the shafts against their being used again, and they labored on sideways over the sand like crabs until the arrows coming so thick and close they made a stand. The kid dropped onto his elbows and cocked and leveled the revolver. The Yumas were over 100 yards out, and they set up a cry, and Toadvine dropped to one knee alongside the kid. The pistol bucked, and the gray smoke hung motionless in the air, and one of the savages went down like a player through a trap. The kid had cocked the pistol again, but Toadvine put his hand over the barrel, and the kid looked up at him and lowered the hammer, and then sat and reloaded the empty chamber, and pushed himself up and recovered his crutch, and they went on. Behind them on the plain they could hear the thin clamor of the Aborigines as they clustered about the one he'd shot. That painted horde dogged their steps the day long. There were 24 hours without water, and the barren mural of sand and sky was beginning to shimmer and swim, and the periodic arrows sprang aslant from the sands about them like the tufted stalks of mutant desert growths, propagating angrily into the dry desert air. They did not stop. When they reached the wells at Alamo Mucho, the sun was low before them, and there was a figure seated at the rim of the basin. This figure rose and stood warped in the quaking lens of that world and held out one hand, in welcome or warning they had no way to know. They shielded their eyes and limped on, and the figure at the well called out to them. It was the ex-priest Tobin. He was alone and unarmed.
"How many are ye?" he said. What you see, said Toadvine. All the rest gone under? Glanton, the judge?
They didn't answer. They slid down to the floor of the well where there stood a few inches of water, and they knelt and drank. The pit in which the well was sunk was perhaps a dozen feet in diameter, and they posted themselves about the inner slope of this salient and watched while the Indians fanned out over the plain, moving past in the distance at a slow lope. Assembled in small groups at cardinal points out there, they began to launch their arrows upon the defenders, and the Americans called out the arrival of the incoming shafts like artillery officers. Lying there on the exposed bank and watching out across the pit toward the assailants in that quarter, their hands clawed at either side of them and their legs cocked, rigid as cats. The kid held his fire altogether, and soon those savages on the western shore who were more favored by the light began to move in. About the well were hillocks of sand from old diggings, and the Yumas may have meant to try to reach them. The kid left his post and moved to the west rim of the excavation and began to fire on them where they stood or squatted on their haunches like wolves out there on the shimmering pan. The ex-priest knelt by the kid's side and watched behind them and held his hat between the sun and the foresight of the kid's pistol. And the kid steadied the pistol in both hands on the edge of the works and let off the rounds. At the second fire, one of the savages fell over and lay without moving. The next shot spun another one around, and he sat down and then rose and took a few steps and sat down again. The ex-priest whispered encouragement at his elbow, and the kid thumbed back the hammer, and the ex-priest adjusted the hat to shade gun sight and sight eye with the one shadow, and the kid fired again. He had drawn his sight upon the wounded man sitting on the pan, and his shot stretched him out dead. The ex-priest gave a low whistle.
"Aye, you're a cool one," he whispered. "But it's cunning work all the same. And wouldn't it take the heart out of you?"
The Yumas seemed immobilized by these misfortunes, and the kid cocked the pistol and shot down another of their number before they began to collect themselves and to move back, taking their dead with them, lofting a flurry of arrows and howling out blood oaths in their Stone Age tongue, or invocations to whatever gods of war or fortune they'd the ear of, and retreating upon the pan until they were very small indeed. The kid shouldered up his flask and shot pouch and slid down the pitch to the floor of the well, where he dug a second small basin with the old shovel there, and in the water that seeped in he washed the bores of the cylinder and washed the barrel and ran pieces of his shirt through the bore with a stick until they came clean. Then he reassembled the pistol, tapping the barrel pin until the cylinder was snug and laying the piece in the warm sand to dry. Toadvine had made his way around the excavation until he reached the ex-priest, and they lay watching the retreat of the savages through the heat shimmering off the pan in the late sunlight.
"He's a dead-eye, ain't he?"
Tobin nodded. He looked down the pit to where the kid sat loading the pistol, turning the powder-filled chambers and measuring them with his eye, seating the balls with the sprues down.
"How do you stand by way of ammunition?"
"Poorly. We got a few rounds, not many."
The ex-priest nodded. Evening was coming on, and in the red land of the west, the Yumas were gathering in silhouette before the sun. All night their watchfires burned on the dark circlet of the world, and the kid unpinned the barrel from the pistol, and using it for a spyglass, he went around the warm sand selvage of the well and studied the separate fires for movement. There is hardly in the world a waste so barren but some creature will not cry out at night. Yet here one was. And they listened to their breathing in the dark and the cold, and they listened to the systole of the ruby-meated hearts that hung within them. When day broke, the fires had burned out, and slender terminals of smoke stood from the plain at three separate points of the compass, and the enemy had gone. Crossing the dry pan toward them from the east was a large figure attended by a smaller. Toadvine and the ex-priest watched.
What do you make it to be?
The ex-priest shook his head. Toadvine cupped his hand and whistled sharply down at the kid. He sat up with the pistol. He clambered up the slope with his stiff leg. The three of them lay watching. It was the judge and the imbecile. They were both of them naked, and they neared through the desert dawn like beings of a mode little more than tangential to the world at large, their figures now quick with clarity and now fugitive in the strangeness of that same light, like things whose very portent renders them ambiguous, like things so charged with meaning that their forms are dimmed. The three at the well watched mutely this transit out of the breaking day, and even though there was no longer any question as to what it was that approached, yet none would name it. They lumbered on, the judge a pale pink beneath his talc of dust like something newly born, the imbecile much the darker, lurching together across the pan at the very extremes of exile, like some scurrilous king stripped of his vestiture and driven together with his fool into the wilderness to die. Those who travel in desert places do indeed meet with creatures surpassing all description. The watchers at the well rose, the better to witness these arrivals. The imbecile was fairly loping along to keep the pace. The judge on his head wore a wig of dried river mud, from which protruded bits of straw and grass, and tied upon the imbecile's head was a rag of fur with the blackened blood side out. The judge carried in one hand a small canvas satchel, and he was bedraped with meat like some medieval penitent. He hove up at the diggings and nodded them a good morning, and he and the idiot slid down the bank and knelt and began to drink. Even the idiot, who must be fed by hand, he knelt beside the judge and sucked noisily at the mineral water, and raised his dark, larval eyes to the three men crouched above him at the rim of the pit, and then bent and drank again. The judge threw off his bandoliers of sun-blacked meat, and his skin beneath was strangely mottled pink and white in the shapes of them. He set by the little mud cap and laved water over his burnt and peeling skull and over his face, and he drank again and sat in the sand. He looked up at his old companions. His mouth was cracked and his tongue swollen.
"Lewis," he said, "what will you take for that hat?"
Toadvine spat.
"It ain't for sale," he said. "Everything's for sale," said the judge. "What will you take?"
Toadvine looked uneasily at the ex-priest. He looked down into the well.
"Gotta have my hat," he said. "How much?"
Toadvine gestured with his chin at the strings of meat.
"I reckon you want to trade some of that tug for it."
"Not at all," said the judge. "Such as is here is for everybody.
How much for the hat?" "What'll you give?"
said Toadvine. The judge studied him.
"I'll give $100, he said.
No one spoke. The idiot, crouched on its haunches, seemed also to be awaiting the outcome of this exchange. Toadvine took off the hat and looked at it. His lank black hair clove to the sides of his head.
"It won't fit ye," he said.
The judge quoted him some term in Latin. He smiled.
"Not your concern," he said.
Toadvine put the hat on and adjusted it.
"I reckon that's what you got in that there satchel," he said.
"You reckon correctly," said the judge. Toadvine looked off toward the sun.
"I'll make it 125, and won't ask you where you got it," said the judge. "Let's see your color."
The judge unclasped the satchel and tipped and emptied it out on the sand. It contained a knife and perhaps a half a bucketful of gold coins of every value. The judge pushed the knife to one side and spread the coins with the palm of his hand and looked up. Toadvine took off the hat. He made his way down the slope. He and the judge squatted on either side of the judge's trove, and the judge put forward the coins agreed upon, advancing them with the back of his hand forward like a croupier. Toadvine handed up the hat and gathered the coins, and the judge took the knife